and be a Viking. Say, yah!
Yah!
If you wanna be a Viking, say, yah! Say, yah! If you wanna be a Viking, say, yah! Say, yah! If you wanna be a Viking, if that's
okay, so I'm here with Tony Stone, who is the writer, director, producer, editor, actor, and probably a number of other things for Severed Ways. What else did you do on this, Tony, and how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Let's see, what else did I do? Additional music. I mean, anything you could come up with on a film, I probably was involved in. Yeah, at times catering.
You know, well, what did you make on this set?
Maybe a couple of pastas. I mean, we would take turns. We would take turns cooking. You know, okay. I mean, so it was. You know, it was made with a small crew in an old hippie shack that my dad built in '69.
Yeah.
In the middle of the woods. So you know, we were just there, isolated. You know, sort of living like our characters. You know, I mean, not as harsh, but you know, off the grid.
Got it.
Okay.
Well, about the additional music.
Yeah.
This suggests to me that all along you had the idea of possibly scoring the entire film, and yet we have a number of musical bands, Queens of the Stone Age, even Judas Priest at one point pops up, that do appear in the film. Was this a scenario that came into play when the film got distribution? Or, licensing's always a bitch.
A lot of that music we were actually listening to while we were making the film.
Oh,
so,
okay.
I mean, I think that's sort of why it actually, meshes together and works, is, that was film that, we're listening to at night or even during the day sometimes, or I'd even listen to on my headphones, just sort of, have that tone in mind, a lot of the bands, it just sort of all songs that I hope would fit and then ended up fitting,
Really?
And so it was
licensing
just,
wasn't a problem at all?
It ended up working out. I mean, it took some time, but we managed to get, there was no piece of music that I had to actually replace, which was amazing and lucky and fortunate,
What do you attribute this to?
I don't know. I mean, that it was maybe the uniqueness of the project. It wasn't usually, what they're used to in terms of people, movies coming at them. It was just, it's sort of, it's an odd thing. So I think people were into just being a part of it and helping out, So it was great. I mean, I really thank every single band. I mean, I just couldn't believe it, that we managed to get them.
They were all Viking fans because
I guess, they all maybe were Viking fans and had battle axes under their bed or something,
Or rather, the PR people, or the clearance people.
But I think they must.
They do have battle axes under their bed.
Yeah, exactly. They do. They're one.
Well, I wanted to ask first of all about the seven chapters that this film has.
Yeah.
Why did you decide upon seven? I mean, seven, of course, is one of those numbers that's the ideal number of people to sit at the dinner table.
Yep.
There's 7 days of the week. Yep. You can go ahead and go into any number of numerological sort of tangents on this.
Exactly.
But I'm really curious about this: why the need for chapters, and also why the need for the end of chapter 4 title, because surely the audience would understand once chapter 5 began that perhaps chapter 4 had ended.
Ended. Yeah, when there's no beginning of chapter 4,
That's right,
So, it is 7 chapters. Just in terms of the story is told in saga form in a way. You read the Vinland sagas or, Njal saga is another great, Norse saga, or any sort of myth or saga. They're very, especially these, they're very direct, and a whole year will pass in a paragraph, So, I mean, that's sort of the rhythm of the film is just sort of, they were here, they land, they chop, they eat, they make fire, whatever else they do, And so it's sort of, sort of telling a full saga, seven being that number, it did sort of, fit in and just seemed like the natural fit,
I understand that this initially started off as a 2-week shoot that expanded into 3 years.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
What happened here? I mean, why couldn't you get everything done in 2 weeks? And why did this expand into 3 years? From what I understand, you kept pretty close to what you initially set out to do, but I am curious about how this occurred.
I think, it's just one of those things where it's like no matter what you're doing, whether you're doing a building project or whatever it is, it's, and usually don't have the luxury with film to do this. It's just everything ends up taking longer to do right, you know? And what's great about doing film now is that, you know, you have a camera that weighs, you know, 3.5 pounds. You really only need one operator, especially film like this. It's all natural sound. There's no, you know, it's not a, you know, it's not like you need a, you know, huge sound unit following you around. It's just, you know, so I could go back and do it and then do it the next year and, you know, film some stuff even the year after. But yeah, it just, I think I also originally was imagining just going into the woods, you know, and just documenting us doing, and it would be much more of a documentary style thing, even though there's some aspects, but that was just immediately so boring to me, you know, so it was definitely sort of constructing little, you know, sort of set pieces of scenes, and just, you know, I think, you know, you sort of learn from doing too. I mean, which is great is I shot for 2 weeks the first year, you know, and had you know, made 1/5 of the film, and then, you know, had this amazing template, and I knew exactly what I wanted going back the next year, you know? So in a way, it was great to get, you know, be totally open-ended, get this sketch, and then go the next year and, you know, have this punch list and, you know, go in between the scenes you don't have, and it just, you know, you educate yourself. It's, I mean, I think it's a great way to shoot, you know, and, you know, Wong Kar-wai has done some sort of stuff like that, but in terms of, you know, getting a sketch and then going back, and you know your material so well, you know the rhythm you want, you know the visuals you want, you know what's working this location, you know. So in a way, it was actually, you know, I mean, I could see myself doing that in future projects. I mean, I think especially if you're trying to tell a story visually, you know, you're not always going to get the visual right the first time. You know, it's very different than working on a scene and working with actors in a dialogue. You know, it's so it's a very different rhythm. So, you know, sometimes you got to try again, you know.
But so. Here's the question that's on my mind. Did you start off with a structure that you quickly diverted and divagated away from, that this was a scenario in which you came up with additional scenes? I'm just trying to understand how 2 weeks transformed into three years.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand on some improvisational, spontaneous level or an organic level, but maybe you could. How did this go get out of hand here?
Yeah, how did it get out of hand? The ending did change. You know, that was for sure. And I think the Native American aspect of it just sort of, that was sort of something I didn't actually have the answer of. I thought maybe we'd figure out the first year, you know. So it was open ended, you know. And then I was able to write off of, you know, story wise, because it's basically, you know, it was a sort of an extended outline, you know. You know, so story wise, from what I shot the first year, I managed to figure out what would be right, you know, and sort of what ends up being there is, I think, you know, was right, you know. And, I mean, a lot of it was there. It was just realizing that you needed to develop it a lot more, you know, that just in terms of, you know, you need to tell an audience what to pay attention to in a way, you know.
What do you mean by develop?
Like, just in terms of, you know, there's so many, instead of just, oh, well, we want some authentic scene of them building, so we're just going to film them building, you know. And for instance, we did the first year, totally boring, totally uninteresting, handheld documentary, you know, just, you know, it's okay to be handheld, but yet there has to be a reason why you're at that angle, all sorts of things. And, you know, so I just felt like this next year there was much more of a visual sort of structure. And, you know, it was also just educational too, you know, I mean, it's that kind of thing where it's just, you know, it's almost like the first year was my first film, the second year suddenly, you know, it's my second film.
So you needed the motivation for the camera angles and a justification for the particular shots, and that's why you were perhaps not happy with the first year, or you need to
advance beyond. A lot of stuff got reshot, you know, I mean, but I really, I couldn't say, you know, strongly enough that I think it's actually a great way to do it if you can, and for your first film, you know. It's crazy to think that in your first film you're going to know what you're doing the first, you know, week, you know. That's going to be a huge lesson, you know, and I think anybody that shoots wants to go back and reshoot everything they shot the first, you know. So it's basically what we did, you know. So the next year we shot the second year, that was, you know, 2.5 months. So, you know, and we went to Newfoundland, and we went to Maine, and we, you know, it's just, everything just expanded. So in a way, you know, I had this sort of loose sketch of visuals that's in the film. It's still maybe like, I don't know how much, but, you know, it was almost, you know, the second year was in a way the real shoot, you know.
But I'm wondering if it extended to 3 years because you were concerned too much about reshooting or getting something right. I mean, yes, as you say, when you make any particular piece of art, you have to accept that, well, this was how I was at that particular time.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't go back and reimagine it, or else you have, you know, Han shoots first.
Well, also the thing is, while it did take 3 years, we were constrained by a season, you know, being fall, you know. So it was, you know, 2 weeks, one first year as a fall, you know, fall first year, second year was, you know, along, you know, stretching out Newfoundland, slowly moving south to Vermont, you know. So, you know, it was, but then, you know, in between shooting, you're going over the footage, and then, you know, so you're editing, you have all these sequences, and then that's when you plug in. And the third year was, you know, very minimal stuff. I mean, reshoots, mostly me just with the camera, just getting stuff that I wanted, you know. So, in a way, you know, it's over 3 years, but in terms of shooting, it wouldn't even be that long a time, you know.
This fish is pretty killer. Well, killer, as I understand it, is a recent modifier in the English language.
Yes,
and I don't think necessarily that the Vikings were using this or that the Nordic tongue had any particular answer towards killer. So
yeah.
Why the modernization of etymology here? Is this a inroad point along the line of the Viking headbanger who likewise appears in this?
Yeah, I mean, it's that, but it's also, you know, a lot of the times you watch any period piece or historical film, whether it's Romans or whatever else, barbarians, and it's, they're speaking in semi-Shakespearean accents and they're all British, you know. It doesn't really make any sense, you know. So, everything's very formal and, you know, there's no reason why 1,000 years ago they weren't just as casual as us and they had their own vernacular, you know? So this is, you know, using a piece of dialogue like This Fish is Killer is basically more of an accurate translation in my mind, because you're taking whatever their vernacular was and putting it into our vernacular so you understand the tone and the vibe of what they're actually saying, you know? So I actually find there's actually more accuracy in it, and we're just sort of been so, you know, beaten down by the traditional Hollywood stupidity of like, dealing with history in films. And, you know, so that's sort of, you know, how I explain it and why, you know, I wanted it there, you know. So, and of course, there's a, you know, it's, I think, you know, the film is always, you know, it's trying to bridge the past and the present. And so it's making, you know, these characters have mannerisms that maybe, you know, the dude walking down the street has or whatever else. It's trying to just not have it be this distant, far off, separate thing. It's trying to make it more, you know, current and now, and it is with us, you know. I mean, you know, so.
But on the flip side, there is a certain point where it becomes ridiculous, i.e., A Knight's Tale, for example, in which you have the Nike swoosh in the Middle Ages. You remember this film?
Yeah, I do.
It was totally ridiculous. It was fun, but at the same time, one does not look to this for verisimilitude. So the question is
back in town,
how far can you go with this?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Knight's Tale, yeah, I forgot about that. It's been a while. But yeah, I mean, they use modern music and they... and I guess they have the
dialogue.
We
Will Rock You, yeah.
Then there's that amazing part where they're going back to London, mm-hmm. and the Thin Lizzy song comes in. Boys are back in town, and yeah. You know, they're back in town. It's really incredible.
I mean, if we're talking about Hollywood stupidity, but I'm wondering how...
Obviously, there is a level of absurdness to it, too. I'm not going to deny it. But, you know, I think the film is sort of rebellious in a way, you know? So it's trying to set up maybe a dialogue. I don't know. You know, I don't know. You know, but in a way, it just, you know, like I'm saying, sort of modernizing the Viking, making him a current character, making him more similar to, you know, to somebody maybe you know, is sort of the idea, you know, and just sort of getting away from that wall that's usually put up in terms of dealing with historical material, you know. But, yeah, I mean, in terms of dealing with Knight's Tale and how far that goes, yeah, I mean, that seemed to have a one-line objective in what they were trying to do, you know, and was a pitch that was probably of, you know, 5 lines and, some producer in Hollywood said, go, you know. So, you know, it was an underdeveloped thing in a way, you know. So.
I guess, though, I mean, the question relates to how far you can actually go in testing the audience's relationship, this dialogue you're talking about, with more contemporary elements to fit in with a more historical setting. I mean, you know, how far can you really go?
Maybe I went too far. I mean, maybe, I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I mean, if you think about it too, in terms of talking about the lines of dialogue that maybe are in vernacular, you know, it's probably not that much, but it's sort of the natural elements of you and me talking, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's, you know, it's not constant, but it's there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I must also ask you about the chickens in this film.
Okay.
I did not see any SPCA notice, so I assume the chickens' heads were indeed cut off and that chicken was indeed ripped from its wings and the like.
Yeah.
Is this your homage to Luis Buñuel's Land Without Bread, in which he shot a donkey? I mean, do you feel any ethical qualms if indeed chickens...
Oh, absolutely not.
Not really? No.
I mean, it's... Well, it's also... There's a great scene in... in a Bergman film, obviously, with a chicken too, but where these bourgeois people can't kill a chicken, even though their survival depends on it. And oh my God, what's that film called? Anyhow, those chickens in the film were probably lived the best life they could possibly live, you know?
Yeah.
They were two-year-old hens that were about to be slayed anyway. They're from our friend's farm, and they fed the entire crew. You know, so in a way, you know, that's as free range as those chicken, as free range of the life a chicken can live, long as the life a chicken will live. You know, so you know, people are squeamish about it, which I find pretty absurd, and I think why it's in there is that, you know, I mean, most people are responsible for an animal death a day and have never killed anything. You know, and I think that's what, you know, the film is also dealing with, is our distance from the physical world, from physical reality, from physical literacy. You know, and how, you know, if society collapses, most people are not fit out to actually survive in this world. They don't know how, you know, and that's a terrifying thing. And, you know, I think it's also, in terms of killing animals, it's really an important understanding, almost, that I think everybody should go through, which is, you know, you're actually looking at an animal in its eye, and it's begging for its life, and you have to take that life, you know, to sustain your existence, you know. And it's just something that this, you know, from factory farms to everything else, that we are so distanced once again from, that it's in there to sort of show that reality, you know, to show what every day, you know, you're responsible, you know, most people in this country are responsible for, you know. So in a way, it's almost from a vegetarian aspect, I would say, even though I am a meat eater, but it is showing, you know,
it's agitating the vegetarian.
It's agitating. Sure it is. But it's also agitating to a meat eater, which is pretty, you know, hypocritical in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I also must ask about the defecation scene. Was that real shit?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you could CGI it, you know, that well, and it would have been quite a cost. Yeah, it is. I mean, the film is obviously a lot about process. It's about action, you know. So that, from them, you know, landing, you know, deforesting, building a camp, making fire, catching fish, that's sort of the end point, you know, and it's sort of an important first act in this new world, you know. I mean, it's about consumption, it's about American consumption, you know, and so, I mean, it's not just there for, you know, the gross factor of it or anything like that, you know. And it's also a very beautiful shot. I mean, I would say it's, you know, through shot leaves, it's very, you know, it's almost Garden of Eden-esque, you know. And, you know, so it's not, you know,
when he squats down, he is very, it's almost as if he's reaching for the toilet paper with that leaf, I must say.
Exactly.
But know? I mean, I have to ask, was there any consideration as to what the male had to eat here in order to get the constituency of this wondrous fecal matter that was shot in this Edenic splendor?
Yeah, you know, me being the blonde Viking in the film, probably maybe a few drinks the night before and a cup of coffee in the morning. Is that what you're suggesting?
I guess, I mean, I'm wondering if you had any real concern over how the shit looked, whether it had to be thick or thin.
Oh, there was a couple that were filmed.
Was there a lot?
So there was
really?
Okay. Yeah, this was the best one, and early in the morning, and the birds chirping. I mean, it was beautiful.
So the birds chirping was more of a consideration than the actual constituency
of
shit
just,
itself.
It was just the place we found ourselves in, the rush to get it out.
Literally. Yeah.
It worked.
I also want to ask, there's a book by Charles Leland called Algonquin Legends. I'm not sure if you've read this, in which Leland was convinced that the Wabanaki were heavily influenced by the Vikings. And since religion does play such an important part in this film, I must likewise ask you why you kind of abstained from the religion in relation to the Abenkis, because you have a dialectic going on with the Vikings and, of course, the Irish monk who may very well be after St. Bernard or whatnot.
Right.
That's another question. I'm going to try to squeeze a whole bunch of money out of time. But why did you not concern yourself with the religious aspect of the Abenkis as much as the Vikings and the Irish monks?
You're talking about the Abenakis.
Abenakis.
Well, I think they... They're coexisting. I mean, there's no real conflict with them, you know. The Vikings are going through a transition at this time between paganism and Christianity, and obviously one of the characters is on the fence about it, you know, while others is still rooted in the earth, you know. But that's also another whole interesting idea to me is that basically it was two pagan populations interacting in America, you know, 1,000 years ago, and the Vikings almost stayed. You know, if Christianity maybe perhaps hadn't entered the picture, you know, until maybe 50 years later, the Vikings, you know, I mean, part of the Vikings' warrior ethos and fearlessness was from the fact that, you know, from their religious belief, you know, I mean, they wanted to die in battle. They were all about the conflict. It was an honor, you know. And so Christianity sort of enters, you know, their society just as they're discovering America, you know. So they might have stayed. They might have, you know, actually coexisted with, you know, the American Indian, and this country would have been, I mean, the whole world would look drastically different now. And how close that was, that almost happened. I mean, you know, they built camps in America. They almost stayed, you know. If they had just stayed a little longer, you know, this, America would have been known throughout Europe, you know, and expeditions would have happened slowly over time instead of 500 years later,
yeah,
coming back armed with, you know, with guns and obviously also and disease and you know, pillaging the earth with, you know, this sort of religious you know, vigor that, you know, the Vikings didn't have, you know. So that's sort of, you know, so that's sort of the interesting idea. But getting back to your question too about why not dealing with the Abenakis is that, you know, they were already subvert. They were coexisting. You know, all their answers were right in front of them, you know. Whereas, you know, the Christianity, you know, it was the book. It was magic. I mean, there was all these other things, these elements to it that were enticing, you know?
Yeah.
So it was sort of a clash between that, between the physical reality and sort of this ethereal sort of created world that's Christianity, where the, you know, where the answer isn't right in front of you. You know, if you're a pagan, it's the water, it's the wind, it's you know, it's the seas, it's you know, the earth. I mean, it's, you know, you have faith in the physical, you know, existence around you. You know, it's not about this far off place necessarily, although the Vikings did have Valhalla and stuff, but, you know, the answer's in front of you, and that's sort of what the Abenakis, you know, representing.
But the interesting assumption on your part is that the decision to let the monk go is predicated upon the religion. And I, as a secular type, looked at this and said to myself, well, why is it so tied in with religion? Are you basing this off of the Leif Erikson view of this relationship, this coexistence with religion? Or?
Well, but you're saying, but the Viking lets them go because of the conflict with the sister, right?
Well, there's that, right. Yeah. So there's a religious undertow.
No, and yeah. and I think the religion, you know, the Christianity in the film is it's not necessarily an anti-Christian film, right? I mean, you know, it represents actually some humanity in the film as well, you know, and some sophistication, you know.
But the humanity is tied in with the religion. That's what I'm saying. That's what's interesting.
No, exactly. No, exactly. You know. So you know, I mean, I think it's also the pureness of what, you know, religion actually maybe can offer too, you know, and also how, you know, we can, you know, rant and rave against, you know, the atrocities that are done because in the name of religion, but it also gave us a form of culture. I mean, it's more complicated, you know. I mean, it gave us the Renaissance and the amazing paintings to, you know, to literature. I mean, you know, it's been a huge, you know, facilitator of amazing culture in a way as well, you know. But, you know, so it's very complicated, you know, of course.
So complicated, and we don't have the time. But Tony, maybe we could pick this up at some later point. But thanks very much for taking the time.
Okay, great talking to you.
Great, thanks. Okay. Yeah. Everybody.